And welcome. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. This week, we've got, as usual, an action-packed show. A lot of people enjoyed our little ramble there last week about some news items. We've got another must-read news item this week, an absolutely amazing article that was out of the Vancouver Observer, if my memory serves me correctly. I'll double-check that later when we actually get to the news item. But some more fire and brimstone, I'm afraid, for those folks who are hoping for a entirely lighthearted show. I may not be able to do that the entire way through. Because we do have that news item, which is, again, is an absolute must-read. We'll post links to it afterwards, but we'll get to that when we get to it. That's about halfway through. We're going to start the program today with Dennis Rugosa. Dennis is the Sustainability Advisor at Canola Council of Canada. He has a lot of interesting things that he's been working on, as well as the council itself represents the value chain of interests for growers for canola. It's one of the highest value agriculture crops worth about $15 billion in Canada as well. So major, major import. Funnily enough, during this interview, it was pre-recorded a couple of weeks ago. We didn't actually ever get to, I was having such a good conversation with him, we never actually got to the part about using canola and possible biofuels and stuff like that. So we will actually, despite that being his introduction, we talk actually more about the, he was CEO of the British Columbia Scrap It program. So we talk about some of the car trade out schemes, stuff like that. He also would talk about just some general environment and business relationships, stuff like that as well. Very, very interesting. And hopefully we will have him back to eventually get to the Canola Council issues, which I had originally booked him for in the first place. Stay tuned as well after that, at the end of the show, after we talk to Kevin Farmer and after we hear from Dennis Rugosa. I also have a couple of guests in the studio as well. It's Christopher Smith and Marette Mueller. I did not butcher anybody's name there. They are the both producer and director as well. Christopher, this in addition, the cinematographer, and Marette, in addition, the writer of Tiny, a story about keeping small as well. Oh, I'm sorry. A story about living small. My apologies. They're from Speak Thunder Films. They'll be in the second half as well to talk about that. But without further ado, we will get to Dennis. So again, this is Dennis Dennis Rugosa, the Sustainability Advisor at the Council of Canada. Just we start off talking about a little bit of his background and get into things like recycling cars and scrapping programs. So we'll start with that. Take it away, Dennis.
I did my Master's degree in Environmental Studies at York. Mm-hmm. Not too far from you there. And it's been a long, interesting journey. When I graduated, I was a lonely soul out there.
So tell me a little bit about that, I guess, then, just kind of starting out, and it was, certainly wasn't the cool rage that environment seems to be, or it feels sometimes like it is these days, you know, with everything from it being a lot more prevalent in our media, whether the coverage is good or bad, it seems to be covered more. Also, you know, companies, you know, greening themselves in some cases, truthfully, in some cases, as far as greenwashing. But do you have any sort of look back, or just as far as how the landscape has changed since you left school?
I mean, it's an interesting question because it's dramatically changed. We're now in a situation where I think when I went to grad school, there were only two universities in Canada offered degrees in the environment, if you will, or environmental studies. I believe that was York and Waterloo, and that's one of the reasons I went to York. I was from Saskatchewan, right? So it was one of the places that had a master's degree program. The only place in Canada that had a master's degree program. Now, I think almost every single university in Canada offers degree programs in environmental studies or equivalent.
Mm-hmm. So and if not entire departments based on the U of T recently, as of the last few years, has a Center for the Environment and that sort of thing that has a whole suite of programs for environmental students. So.
It's like rabbits, you know, everywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess maybe that would be a really good place to start. I mean, based on your experience, we've seen an explosion of at least, you've identified it at the very least, educational opportunities in the environment. Have you seen this result in change in the way that that businesses relate to the environment outside of it being more popular? Have businesses really been greening? Has this been something that's been a legitimate change?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you just look in the, an indicator of this would be jobs advertised, right? Mm-hmm. If you go back 30 years ago and said, well, how many jobs are advertised out there? People have a background in environmental studies or specific areas within that field, and there are almost none. Today, if you pick out newspapers or whatever source of ads you're looking for, there's a wealth of ads out there. Many companies really have moved to adopt the philosophy and the practice related to this, and there are varying degrees of scale, I would say. But certainly many, many, many companies have done this, whereas previously there were no such jobs before.
Tell me a little bit, that relates, I think, to the Scrap It program that you run. If you can tell us a little bit about that story. So you, if I understand correctly, you helped start it while you were working with the government of British Columbia, and then a few years later they asked you to come back and help run the program. Do you want to just tell the listeners a little bit about what the Scrap It program?
Yeah, well, the Scrap It, it's called the BC Scrap It program. It's active only in British Columbia, obviously, and the history around the program was that had it was one of the first programs to be actually an emissions offset program. And back in the mid-1990s, the government of British Columbia had been looking and taking very aggressive action to reduce smog-related pollutants, primarily in the Greater Vancouver area. And one of the ways to do that would be look at all the different kinds of sources of emissions. And one of the interesting sources of emissions was when you actually refuel your vehicle. So, as you may know, with older vehicles, that when you pull up the gas station and you turn the hose on, quite often there's a cloud, an invisible cloud of hydrocarbons that meet your face. There was new technology established that's been active in the U.S. for 30 years, I would say, called, and the technical name is Stage 2 Vapor Recovery, because Stage 1 is when the big tanker trucks drive up to the gasoline stations, and when they fill up, all the vapors in the tanks are displaced by the liquid and vent into the atmosphere. So that those liquids, in turn, are hydrocarbons, which are part of the smog problem. So they solved that problem by ensuring that the vapors that do come back that would normally be displaced in the atmosphere are recaptured and go into back into the tanker truck and then go back into the terminal and back in the refinery. So the equivalent to that, those when you fill up your own car or truck. And the technology there is called Stage 2 Vapor Recovery. And so we had proposed installing that. We, meaning the BC Ministry of Environment when I worked there, had proposed installing that technology across all the refueling stations in the Greater Vancouver region. And we began a lot of detailed discussion with the oil industry about that and concluded that it was going to be very expensive. And really halfway through those negotiations with the oil industry, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced that it was going to require new technology in all new vehicles sold today, sold effective the model year 2000, which meant that you would no longer have vapors escaping into the atmosphere. They're going to be recaptured inside the vehicle. So if you had two vehicles, let's say a 1995 Brand X and a 2005 same Brand X, and you filled them up side by side, the 1995 vehicle would result in a cloud of hydrocarbons coming at your face. The 2005 vehicle wouldn't do that anymore. Hmm. So a lot of people today, when you fill up your vehicle, it's a very, very tight connection to the vehicle. And that results in the recapture of vapors. So that result was that the technology changed. We decided not to do that, but as part of negotiations with the oil industry, we looked at an alternate way of delivering the equivalent amount of emission reductions into the atmosphere and concluded that a scrap program would, in fact, do that because when you scrap older vehicles, they are super polluters. And I can tell you that studies that we've done in the Scrapper program indicate some of these vehicles are from, on average, 60 times more polluting than a new vehicle. Let's say if you take a 1995 vehicle versus a 2005 or 2013 vehicle, they're about 60 times more polluting from a smog point of view. We've done some testing on vehicles that are 500 times more polluting. This is really not a surprise because if you look at old cars, they're run down. The technology is older. The parts have deteriorated. They've been poorly maintained, when you get 20, 25-year-old vehicles. So that result is we felt that we could really make a difference out there by having a program that would take those old, the super polluted vehicles off the road and have an equivalent emission benefit to the installation of the Stage 2 vapor recovery system at a gasoline station.
So, Dennis, one of the things that jumps out at me right there, though, it's a question I've always been very interested in things like the study of full cost accounting and life cycle analysis and that sort of thing. So I'm interested. I'm sure you had some studies during when you were analyzing what the best way to deal with this issue was. I'm interested to know how you compare. For instance, if you do convince someone to pull, say, that 1995 Brand X off the road, in what way or how do you look at Okay, well, you've taken, you know, the more polluting vehicle off the road, and that person then drives a less polluting vehicle. Has it taken into account the sort of carbon and water and resource cost of building that new vehicle? How is that all balanced?
Yeah, I mean, we don't do detailed analysis around that because we make a couple of assumptions that that vehicle is coming off the road sooner or later anyways, and that what we're doing is we're offering incentives for people to retire it more early. So that from a, you know, your point of view about your points you just made about, you know, carbon issues and so on, sooner or later that vehicle's coming off the road. There are no 50-year-old vehicles left on the road, right? So
right.
It's all going back in the recycling system. I mean, all our vehicles go back, are properly recycled, and go into the steel making system and come back as toasters or whatever, you know?
Right.
So, but what we, where we believe we make a difference, and scrap programs do that, is you normally the vehicles we get are not what I call beater vehicles. They're vehicles that are being driven, they're fully licensed, except they're super polluters, and they're likely going to be on the road another 5 or 10 years. So we offer incentives to those people to do early retirement. So the early retirement benefit is a direct smog reduction benefit.
Well, because they're not...
We know if we get off the road sooner, then we have it's replaced either by a bus pass or a bike or car share or another new vehicle, then in fact there will be significant smog reduction benefits. And there have been studies done about our program and its effectiveness, and it clearly shows that, because we've removed like 33,000 vehicles off the road in BC. It's a lot of vehicles,
yeah,
but they're all 60 times polluting more average. So you can imagine what the impact it's had on the air quality. And generally speaking, if you look at the Vancouver region over the last 15, 20 years, there's been a significant improvement in terms of reduction in smog. I mean, we're having fewer and fewer bad air days, if you will. I can't speak to for big cities like Toronto, Montreal, because you have, you know, very hot summer weather there. But certainly in the Vancouver region, there's fewer smog day alerts than there ever has been. And we're part of that solution. We're not the only solution that's doing that, but we're part of that.
I'm interested if you can tell me a bit more about. I mean, you've had sort of a unique experience. You've been in the public sector and the private sector, and it looks like there's some even some nonprofit type work that you've done. And of course, you also have your own consulting, so you've had an opportunity to look at many other people's businesses as well as your own work experience. Something that we like to talk about on this program is the relationship between both citizens and government, but also business and government. So having had a little bit of experience in all sectors and as your own private citizen, can you comment at all about ways that, that business and government could work together in the best sorts of ways? And just what I'm just for context on that, like I've asked a lot of business people about where they think the position for policy on, you know, not choosing the new technology, but in, just in sort of inspiring inspiration. Can you comment at all about that, about how governments and businesses can work together for the environment?
Yeah, I think there's two dimensions to this issue. One is what I call public policy and how that's generated and the net effect of that and how that reflects the public will and how that's expressed by government. And secondly is how government responds, well, how private industry responds to that. So on the public policy side, generally speaking, if you look at the environmental areas as an example, there's been substantial changes over the last couple of decades in this area. There's a huge sensitivity now to issues around sustainability, for example, just huge. I mean, you have, for example, an organization called Sustainability Consortium, which consists of membership by the 100 largest corporations in the world. You know, the Walmarts, the Safeways, the so on and so on. Like, I mean, we're talking world scale multinational corporations are all part of that particular organization, looking for solutions in response to their perception of the public interest and also how that's expressed in the marketplace. So it isn't just sort of government. It's also a sense by major companies that their customers care about this. So governments can come along with regulations sort of and set the ground rules for sort of the minimum conditions. But in fact, we're now seeing that there's a lot more activity by private industry to go beyond that. And certainly on the environmental issue over the last 30 years, dramatic changes there. Now you're seeing it more formally. You're seeing it formally in areas like certification, like the, some of the supply chains, and a supply chain could be from farm field to end customer and everything in between that. that many of these supply chains have now moved forward with full independent certification against pretty rigorous standards. So we're kind of at the beginning of that, I would say, in any kind of formal way. You know, you see some of it. There's bits and pieces around it in different sectors of the economy. You know, you're now seeing it in plastics, for example, bioplastics. You're seeing it in the food sector. Organics, for example, the certification systems. That, you know, some of them may not be perfect, but as a general direction in society, that's the way we're headed. And I would say we're the wheels are speeding up. The train is going faster down that track, and the track is a fairly new track.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good thing, I would say. How it's expressed is different by sectors, by company, and so on. But in some ways, I would say industry's ahead of government on that one, because in fact they're anticipating the future, and they're doing it for competitive advantage reasons. And also, they've done a lot of market research with their customers to find out what their customers' interest is and what their priorities are. So depending on the sector out there, that as a result, companies are really being, some are being very aggressive in this field, and are taking the issue of environment and sustainability very, very seriously.
One of the things that we've been noticing over the past few years here at the program, and as have many other agencies in Canada, is that, you know, regardless of anyone's position on the government itself, the current federal government's most of their efforts in the sector of the environment are kind of demonstrably centered around removing regulation, or as opposed to introducing new legislation. That the most of their actions with regards to the environment have been around taking rules away. One of the comments that we've heard from many business leaders for years now is that in many cases, businesses would there was, for instance, during Stéphane Dion with Green Shift here in Canada a few years ago, that a lot of companies were saying, you know, we would love to proceed on some of these environmental issues, but we need an indicator from the government as so that we can plan. And we can't be effective businesses and do what we were designed to do, which is make people money, if we don't know where policy and regulation is going to be in the future. So with that as a context, with this current stage, I mean, you've just mentioned now that you think that businesses, and I would tend to agree with you, that businesses in general, depending on the sector that you're talking about, are increasingly becoming interested and are becoming increasingly sincere in their interest about the environment. In your opinion, though, is there an upper limit to that with so few positive indicators from the government, whether you mean positive as a sense of like progressive or positive as in they are removing regulation rather than adding regulation? Is there really much room for businesses to capitalize on all this new energy and excitement of their customers when government seems to not want to be involved in that at best?
Well, I think the answer is maybe sector dependent. If you look at maybe, let's say, the resource sector, mm-hmm. Which tends to be involved with the extraction and production of raw materials, it's very regulatory driven, because that's a requirement out there. If you look at the contrast that with the, say, the food sector, in which there are regulations that affect food production, no question about that, and those are required. But many of the, if you just walk down the supermarket shelf and look at the different products out there and sort of say, how many of those are really governed by government regulation versus consumer-driven issues? And I think I'd suggest that certainly in that particular sector, consumer preference and consumer understandings is probably the big driving factor for that particular sector. So it sort of depends, right, on what sector you're talking about and how the interface with government and how much interface is really required. I mean, for example, a box of cornflakes, certainly there's some government regulation that applies really upstream in the supply chain. But once you get into the processing area and go downstream to that, the market research and the customer interface is really what affects more of a product like that than would be government regulation. So I think the answer depends.
Mm-hmm.
It is also true that I think having a level playing field is important for companies, because from a competitive point of view, it's important to know that if they're making certain investments to achieve a certain objective, that everybody else in the sector is doing the same thing. And so I think maybe some industries are wary of that and don't want to move ahead of regulation if the regulation's not there. And I think it's fair to say also industries are also wary of the fact that even though there may be signals from government that there might be a regulation in a certain area, that in fact it could be the case that regulation is never forthcoming. I personally know of examples where companies have made significant investments ahead of regulation to find out that regulation never happened and they had overinvested, if you will, versus their competition. So government needs to bring certainty, policy certainty, regulatory certainty to the table, that's for sure. Whether it's enough regulation or not, that's always a debate, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look at a specific issue to really make the argument one way or the other.
All right. Well, that was really great hearing from Dennis. As I said, we originally had him on to talk about canola Council of Canada. Didn't get there because I was having such a fun time with him. So we'll definitely have Dennis Rogoza back on in the future to continue. However, we will stop it there. We're going to go to a short music break, and then I'm going to come back. I've actually pulled a couple of our guests into the studio ahead of time to help us discuss our news item, and then we will be getting to the documentary as well a little bit later in the show, which, of course, is Tiny, A Story About Living Small. Without further ado, though, we're going to go to a music break. As a reminder as well, all our music when she's not busy getting married and stuff like that is produced by chosen at least by DJ Amber Waves of the Open Till Midnight Music blog. Links to all the songs and everything will be put up on the website as usual. We actually didn't play one of the songs from last week and the band actually noticed, so as an apology I'm going to be making sure that I play that song today. So the music we're going to do now is Orbit Over Luna, and the rest of the music today will all be by the Honey Runners. That's what she sent us today, and links to all the songs, and I believe you can actually download some of them for free as well today. We'll be up after the show. So without further ado, we're going to go to a music break and we'll be right back. Right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster. You're listening to The Green Majority. I've roused Kevin from his busy work or slumber. I'm not sure where I've gotten you from. Kevin, are you there?
Hi, Darren.
Well, I wasn't from bed because you sound really awake this week. That's good because people really enjoyed some of our Fire and Brimstone from last week. I'm going to pull it back out. I didn't even really have to look very hard. It was one of the articles that was bumped up right to the top. You posted it on the Green Majority page, and I had to read it. It was an incredibly good article because One of the angles as well is that all our listeners should know as well is that we don't necessarily go after specific issues. It's more about, you know, arguments and types of arguments and about correct information so that people can make good decisions. We try very hard not to tell people what to think, and even when we do, it's kind of like, okay, this is my opinion, but, you know, feel free to disagree. What I really, really liked about this article, it was from the Vancouver Observer from May 1st, if I'm not mistaken. April 29th was when it was posted. It's called Oil Sands Bitumen Exports Undermine Canada's Economic Failure. failure. And just before we get into, before I go to you for comment, Kevin, what I really, really liked about this article was it listed all sorts of issues with what the Harper government has been actually saying about what they wanted to do with policy to their, like, part of their own campaign, and then switching policy was pretty much done. It maps it out in basis to when certain applications were made by oil companies. And what's great about it is that it's basically an incredibly good argument as to why you shouldn't trust either the oil companies or the Harper government on their claims about any development having to do with the oil sands without needing to even necessarily mention the word environment. It's you could not care about the environment at all. And it still just shows that basically the oil companies are in charge and they're enriching themselves at the cost to Canadians. And then you can then add all the environment stuff. But I just loved how they made that article. You sort of make an argument that's very environmentally relevant, but they were able to make it without even necessarily needing to mention the word environment. So I will go to you for your comments. And then I should let everybody know I've got Christopher joining us for the next feature, sitting in the studio as well. So Chris, if you want to jump in at any point, go ahead. But we'll start with you, Kevin.
Yeah, so you kind of summed up what I liked about the article, too. It was a few weeks ago on the show when we were talking about the tar sands that I made a comment that Harper is moving us from a value-added economy to a resource extraction economy, and that didn't even make economic sense. And this presentation, this article, which is made out of a presentation, it sums it up nicely without even delving into the environment. And it just, you know, the money, if you're going to be a resource economy, the money isn't in exporting raw materials. The money really is in value-added manufacturing, or in this case, refining. Like, it doesn't make sense to export raw bitumen. It would make sense to refine it, you know, add value to it, and ship the final product.
And just to add context, I'll let you keep going, but just to put things into context as far as what you're talking about for the listeners, when we're talking about things like banana republics, and when you read your history books about things that have been done to various states in Africa and other places where the first world companies, major multinational companies, have gone in, basically strip mined a resource and then left. The country is never left rich, and that's the comparison they're making here, is that that's what these companies are doing to Canada. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to put that into context as far as historically how they should be thinking about this. But sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the meantime, we've got a bad case of what's called Dutch disease, a classic case of Dutch disease, where our dollar has become extremely strong because it's now pegged to our petrochemical extractions, and it's as the dollar rises, exports fall, and it hollows out the manufacturing sector in other regions, notably Ontario and also in Quebec, and so you've got, so essentially what we're doing is so now to take it back sort of to an environmental slant, we're just raiding our natural resources and selling them at the lowest possible value. I mean, I personally,
being the Canadian government or the Canadian people, selling it to the companies at the lowest possible value to us. Just to be clear,
exactly,
about what you're saying.
Yeah. Like, don't get me wrong. I think we should halt tar sands exploitation immediately, and that every last molecule of carbon, or atom of carbon, needs to stay in the ground. But just looking at it sort of from the point of view of the situation that we've got on our hands right now, we've got we're exploiting the tar sands at the getting the least possible bang for our buck, and in the meantime we're making ourselves, as the article points out, we're making ourselves highly dependent on increased imports of condensate to dilute this bitumen so we can push it through pipelines.
And which if my memory serves is not actually because it's easier or more profitable. They're just doing that because it's a loophole in the environmental protections.
Yeah, it gets worse.
Yeah. It's like those nesting dolls. You keep it, the more you look into it, the worse the details are.
Yeah, so we're getting really, very little value for these decisions. It's not like it doesn't, like, the argument is that, I was looking at Canada's economic action plan online, and it goes on and on about safe, responsible resource development, and I just had to, I couldn't read anymore after that. And you know, so what we've got, like, I mean, what that means is that's code for, you know, tar sands exploitation. And so, you know, we're just raiding these natural resources and really not getting very much out of them, and in, you know, increasing our environmental and economic vulnerability in the process. And at the end of the day, we don't even achieve energy security for Canada. This is all sort of destined for foreign markets, leaving Eastern Canada dependent on foreign imports for oil. This is what they tout as the centerpiece of their job creation strategy, and it just doesn't, you know, the emperor's got no clothes, and this article really makes excellent, easy to follow points with clear, very, very clear, concise arguments about why this doesn't even make economic sense. And so, you know, maybe the last the emperor is now finally undressed, and we can say resoundingly no to tar sands exploitation, and get back to, and with that done, we can get back to, say, loving the environment.
If I can take your metaphor one silly step further, we can say the emperor has no clothes, and now you can see his giant tattoo he got when he was 17 that says property of Exxon in his belly button. Anyway, again, this was what I'm calling our must read article of the week. Definitely take a look at it. Again, it's not just an article. It's basically, as Kevin said, it's a condensed presentation, a lot of visuals, a lot of pictures are on it. I really, really encourage everybody to go look at it. It will be posted up there as well. I do want to quickly get Christopher's got another perspective on it here as well. I'll get just a quick comment from you as well again, and then we'll move on to actually talk about why you're actually here.
Yeah. Well, I'm from the States, and actually down there we deal with a lot of the same issues that you're dealing with. In fact, with the Keystone XL pipeline, we're seeing a lot of the, you know, these multinational corporations coming in and basically externalizing the costs of the resource extraction onto local communities and the environment, and then internalizing all the profits and putting very few of those back into the communities. And I think it really does underscore, like the article suggests, the collusion between these governments and, I mean, between our governments and these multinational corporations. And yeah, it's a real travesty, but it's such a difficult problem to deal with. I don't know.
So it's, you're saying it's a familiar story then?
Oh yeah. I think it's being repeated in countries all over the planet. In fact, nationalities, I think, really don't have much to do with it other than the fact that there are slightly different laws in each company. But it's really more of a struggle between, you know, communities and vulnerable populations and these larger, companies and the sort of corporatist elite of our countries, if you will.
All right, so we'll leave it there. Again, we just want to make sure people read the article. We're going to go to a quick music break as well and come back, but I think the last point there that you're making is one that we'll end on the emphasis of, which is that sort of what I was saying before, where, you know, I think as the rich, as members of community, people who are citizens of some of the richest nations on the planet, you know, everyone I think at this point has heard about, you know, at some point they've come across the information that, you know, all the there's specific metals that are, you know, in everybody's Apple iPhones and all that stuff that come from and they're being strip mined from places like the Congo and stuff like that, and people are aware of it, but they kind of deal with it because it's far away. And you know, you could probably do a 10-part series on the psychology of why people know that other people are being abused for your benefit and you don't do anything about it. But hate to break it to you folks, wake up. They're now coming here to do it to us. And if it didn't wake you up that everyone else, people elsewhere in the world are getting ripped off by these companies, congratulations, they've finished strip mining Africa and they're coming after Canada. And if you should have been mad the first time, but if you weren't mad then, get mad now. So anyway, we'll end on that. We're going to go to a music track. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. All right, and we were back. We are back. I'm back in the studio with Rhett Mueller. Hasn't spoken yet, but she's been in the studio. Hello.
Hello.
And Christopher, of course, you heard his voice a few minutes ago. Christopher Smith, hello.
Hi.
Official hose this time. We're here today to talk about a documentary you've been working on called Tiny, A Story About Living Small. It's a bit of a personal journey for the two of you, so I think maybe it would be best if you introduced it in your own words. Do you want to just tell me a little bit about exactly what that project was and where it came from?
Sure. So the film is about people who live in tiny houses, which are houses probably about the size of a parking space. And our film chronicles Christopher's journey of building one of these tiny houses from scratch with no building experience. And then we also traveled around mostly the U.S. Profiling people who live in these extremely small spaces full time.
And so you're not talking about New York condos in that case. You mean actual like small house. So give me an idea. Small is a very relative term. Give me an idea what you mean by small.
Yeah. So most of them are less than 200 square feet. So again, thinking about the size of a parking space.
Wow.
And many of them are built onto flatbed trailers, actually as a way to get around building and zoning codes. Because when they're built on wheels, they count as temporary structures. Because many counties in Canada, as well as U.S., have minimum house sizes. So this is sort of an act of civil disobedience to live smaller than what is sanctioned by the law.
All right. Would you add anything to that, Christopher?
No, that's pretty good. I think we should mention real quick that our film is playing at Hot Docs this week.
Mm-hmm.
And in Hot Docs, you guys have an amazing documentary culture up here, and it's been really great to be up here. But I just felt like
I live actually right near one of the studios, so it's been even if I hadn't been interested, I'm sort of forced to know about it because I have to walk through crowds to get anywhere at my house right now. So yeah, it's very very big on Hot Docs. In case that we do some time shifting, so from the other syndicates. So in case you're listening to this after the fact, today is May 2nd or May 3rd. May 3rd. There we go. Just so you know. So when exactly we'll be playing for folks in case they're not hearing it live, when are they able to actually take a look?
Yeah, well, we've already had two screenings. Unfortunately, they've passed, but we have one more remaining, and that's on Sunday at 1:30 at the Review on, I'm going to butcher this, but Roncesvalles.
Roncesvalles. Yeah, that's just in the West End of Toronto. If you're from outside, it should be pretty easy to find as well. So talk to me a little bit about actually just like producing it and what the experience of was of going this through. It's a personal journey for you guys. So tell me about sort of how this started and what has sort of happened as you were making the film.
Yes. So this basically all started because, I grew up in a military household and actually so did Mrett for a bit. And I moved a lot, so I never really had a real sense of home anywhere in particular. But I'd always had this dream of building a cabin in the mountains. And about 2 years ago, I had just kind of been getting over some health issues. And it occurred to me that if I didn't start working towards my dreams now, and I was about to turn 30, so it felt like a good time, a significant time to maybe just start, you know, looking for some land in the mountains and with the intention to build this cabin on it. And so just on a whim, I went up to the mountains one day and I bought some land and then I was looking into what to do with it. And I wanted to, you know, I bought this land because I loved the landscape up there and I didn't want to have a big impact on the land. So I was trying to look at options to sort of use it without overdeveloping it. And so I was thinking about, you know, a 300 to 400 square foot cabin. And when I called the building department, it turns out that that's illegal. And I remembered an article that I'd read a few years ago in Yes Magazine about tiny houses, which are, you know, these small houses on wheels. And I just kind of put it all together that they're on wheels because, you know, to get around those types of laws that don't seem to really make a lot of sense anymore. The film came about, maybe Mrett, you want to jump in here?
Sure. Yeah. So Christopher has a background in filmmaking and was looking for a project. And I'm a writer by trade. And so I kind of saw him planning the tiny house project and thought that, you know, it would make a great story for a film. So we sort of were exploring questions about home and sort of what makes a good home and how we find ourselves at home through the lens of these extremely small spaces, both through Christopher's personal journey of building the house from scratch and then also interviewing these people around the country who have actually found more of a community and more of a sense of place through these small structures. I think, you know, because Christopher was environmentally motivated in wanting to live tiny, we thought that everyone else that we met would also be environmentally motivated. But we were really surprised that most everyone was financially motivated.
Mm-hmm. And so was there any sort of, when you were meeting people who definitely were coming at it from a financial point of view, was there any sort of sense of awareness about the environmental impact at all? Or was that really even an issue that had come up for any of those folks?
Yeah, there definitely was. One of the couples in our film actually said we're interested and motivated by environmental issues, but they were doing it primarily for the quality of life and for happiness. And I think that underscores a point that a lot of times environmentalists sort of kind of overlook a little bit. But when we live, you know, kind of in harmony with nature, a lot of times the result of that is a better quality of life. And so it's easy to sort of get caught up in the myth that, you know, quality of life comes at the, you know, at, by consuming these resources at the destruction of the environment. And this shows a different way of doing that.
Mm. I was thinking about fun t-shirts we could do because we're starting to think about some promotional material for the Green Majority. And one of the things that occurred to me was to get a picture of a tombstone with the epitaph reading, "Ha ha, I consumed more than you," with like fancy gold lettering on it and everything like that. Just getting at that mindset. And do you, like, is that sort of the part of the tie-in you're getting, is that there is that intrinsic link? But like when we, for instance, when we talk about energy, people say, well, we'll build more wind turbines, or maybe we should have nuclear, maybe we shouldn't have nuclear. But they're really the easiest way to say to have more environmentally friendly power is that there's massive, like 40% savings that can be done by updating energy efficiency, for instance. And so this is kind of like another way of looking at that same thing about just by consuming less. Congratulations, guess what? Less things cost less money. It's a pretty easy, translation. Did you find that maybe there would be more people that would be interested in this sort of thing if they sort of really realized what, like, maybe upplaying rather than upplaying the environment, maybe upplaying the financial benefits, that maybe that would be a better way to maybe get more people interested?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's definitely a possibility, and that would probably have the impact of getting more people interested. You know, stepping back from the movie director role here, but I am kind of curious about what that means, though, if we sort of always, if we keep using these arguments as environmentalists, you know, that the best reason to do things is for economic reasons. And I think that underscores the point that the environment only has economic benefits to us, instead of saying that, you know, maybe it's, you know, maybe that's not the point, is about saving. Maybe, I don't know. That's just a side thought. But
sure. Mariette, I'd like to hear your
Too. Why the quality of life argument is so compelling, because it comes back to, you know, if you're not spending all of your time and resources on consuming things, you have more time to form, you know, meaningful relationships with people and to participate in your community and to pursue creative projects and have a family and all the things that, you know, do have direct impacts on your level of happiness and fulfillment in life. And I think, you know, especially when we're looking at homes, that says a lot, because houses are such a status symbol. And, you know, I think a lot of people think that bigger is better just because, you know, that's what they've earned, without necessarily thinking, well, is this really contributing to the quality of life? Is this what I need or what I want?
I'm really glad you brought that up, actually, because what I was just about to ask you about was there is that perception of, you know, people say, you know, when they hear, so, oh, I'll have a small home and to avoid, you know, because I'm, you know, I want to, you could tell them the whole story, right? I mean, you're trying to be more sustainable and I wanted to live in the thing, but to avoid, you know, silly laws that don't really seem to make sense, we have our house on wheels. And then astutely, what does everybody's image go to is, okay, so you live in a trailer park. And that's not just a description, that's a judgment people are making. Oh, you're trailer park, right? Like, that's an adjective people use, not a description. So, well, what about that sort of that, I'm missing the right word there, but with the bad label, the negative ideas and connotations that come around with simply what you needed to do to make this happen?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point, and I think that what's really important to note about tiny houses in particular is that they actually are miniature houses. They look like houses. They have that traditional, you know, gabled roof, and they're really beautiful and aesthetically pleasing. And that's, I think, a major component of what makes a tiny house not a trailer. And I think that that's also what might make them so successful at, you know, at sort of shifting people's perceptions of, you know, small being cool and not a bad thing necessarily. One of our guests, they made a house called the Proto House. It was Anne and Darren Holly, and she said in her interview with us, you know, like, what's great about tiny houses is they look like a house. If you asked a kid to draw a house, it would look just like a tiny house, and that sort of allows them to, allows you to accept them a lot quicker, you know. And so I think it's a great way to get people to consider to downsize.
And so there's sort of two components to that too. There was the people the fact that it isn't exactly the same thing as a trailer park, but just that people get that image. That's sort of one issue. The other issue as well is just that it was sort of what Moret was more getting at, I think, which was just the idea that there's some sort of negative, the status symbol argument, that there's just some, it doesn't matter if you want to call it a trailer park or a tiny house, that the fact that you want a small space and to do this, it identifies you as not, you'd only be interested in doing that because you don't have the resources for something better, and that means you're poor, and that means a whole bunch of other certain judgments about you. Would you agree with that? And B, have you come into that yet, any of that reaction at all to people when you're talking to them about this?
Yeah, I think that, one of the things we've really tried to focus on in the film is sort of the beautiful design aesthetics and looking at all the design solutions. And I think that's, a way of proving to people that this is creative and interesting and beautiful. It's not, a consolation prize.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, there are a lot of applications for people who are living small, not by choice, by necessity. That's sort of another issue of looking at how we can use kind of these design innovations to make small spaces livable for everyone. Because I do think that, even though a lot of these issues have come up around, the economy crash a few years ago and things like that, even as the economy does improve, our environmental situation, as we all know, is not necessarily improving. And so these are questions that everybody is going to have to start really seriously asking, regardless of, what they can afford.
Mm. And I would only add to that, because I have a lot of friends in finance and business who say, I wouldn't be so sure that the economy is on the way back up anyway, by the mm-hmm. way. That's officially not a stock tip. Please, nobody take any advice literally. I've just been, a lot of the people that I've been speaking to have said that, it's a bit of an illusion that we're out of the woods and that we should still continue to be concerned. And maybe this isn't the time to go out and buy a $200,000 house, perhaps. Maybe this is another argument for why you've got the right idea.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit about the design. Talk a little bit about some of the issues that came up when you're trying to make a tiny house.
Yeah. So I think the biggest issues that come up are actually more financial ones. Because they're not traditional structures built on a foundation, you can't finance them the way that you would finance a regular house. So it actually, even though they're significantly cheaper, I think the house that I built was $26,000 American dollars, and that's significantly cheaper than another house would be to build on a foundation. But I couldn't get a loan for it, so you have to have that money up front, and there's sort of a barrier to entry there. You also can't insure them, and
that's a really interesting angle. No insurance can be applied to it at all, any type of anything at all, or you're totally on your own?
There's nothing that I'm aware of. I think that some people have tried to get them certified as actually a home-built camper, thinking that they would be able to insure it then under a normal camper policy. But it turns out, because it wasn't built by a manufacturer, they won't cover it because they can't vouch for the safety. There's no one to sue or whatever. Yeah.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
It is interesting how this is a very DIY grassroots movement of people who are, I think it's gaining enough momentum and enough press attention that I think the industries will eventually start paying attention. I mean, we're seeing IKEA is coming out with a tiny house prototype. And I think as, sort of bigger businesses start paying attention to this trend, hopefully we'll see, building codes updated and insurance models and financing models also updated as well.
Mm-hmm. And so what would be the next step then? Where are you at now with your project? Are you ready? Have you moved in?
Yeah, the house, we completed the house back in May of last year. So mm-hmm. exactly a year ago today, actually.
Wow. Awesome. Perfect timing. I did that totally intentionally.
Yeah. And it sits up on the land that I bought. And it's actually we cover this in the film a bit, but we don't live in it full time. It was always meant as a long term place to come back to that I feel connected to a certain place, because with homes there, I think that there is something that's really important about a sense of place, and so it was sort of about creating this long term home. Even though I'm sort of a mobile person, it's a place to go back to. So, but it's finished. We moved in. We've spent a lot of time up there. It's absolutely amazing and gorgeous. And as we were building it, and even since then, I wish actually that it was in a place that I could live in it full time. And so we're sort of looking at different possibilities to potentially make that happen down the road. But we've been so busy traveling with the film that it's sort of on the back burner at the moment.
Yeah. Absolutely. So is the plan then, once you're done touring with the film, is then to go back there afterwards?
Well, we can't really see that far down the road at the moment.
Oh, sure. Well, fair enough.
yeah, because it looks like we're probably going to be doing this for at least.
I guess the answer if you're touring with a film is hopefully not anytime soon, right?
Right. That means we got to keep going.
The more busy. Well, we'll see. Hopefully, some extra people heard about that. We've only got a couple of minutes left, but maybe we'll just some final comments, perhaps about looking forward. If people are interested in the sorts of things, where can they go to look for information? Maybe you mentioned that IKEA was working on a prototype. Any other resources that you might be able to direct people to? Frequently asked questions, anything like that?
Yeah, definitely. First of all, I would say our website is www.tiny-themovie.com, and that's where you can find more information about our documentary and also links to a lot of other blogs and websites that have information about tiny houses. And we're also on Facebook, facebook.com/tinythemovie. And I would also encourage people, I mean, if you've never seen a tiny house before, you know, go over to Google and type in tiny house in Google Images, and I think you'll be really pleased and excited by the kind of images that you see pop up.
Definitely.
Awesome. And then, so as far as the prototypes and stuff, is there one of my concerns, just as I don't necessarily do it myself at that time, but I really like that idea and things like people becoming gardeners, and that's been something that's been exploding a lot. I went to a Occupy Gardens event here at Queen's Park a few days ago, and there seems to be a little bit of a revival about people being willing to sort of put their own hands in the dirt, whether it be gardening or building stuff or that sort of thing. So as far as the actual construction or sourcing materials, as far as that, was there any sort of roadblocks or tips you can give people about either where to get the information or, you know, beware of this or anything like that?
Not in particular. I would say that most communities do have reclaimed lumber and reclaimed building supply stores, and we got a lot of stuff from there. And but they're typically built just like a normal house, so anywhere they would source something for a normal house, you know, you could source things for tiny houses. But
yeah. Okay. So I think that was absolutely great. Thank you so much. And again, if you want to just say again, you just gave the website. If you want to just remind people again, it's May the 5th will be this Sunday.
Yes.
This Wednesday. So if they're in Toronto, what time can they
1:30 p.m. at the Review Theater.
At 1:30. And of course, they can look up
tiny-themovie.com.
Oh, no. I was thinking I get confused between all the festivals. Oh, here. It is Hot Docs that's on.
Yeah, it is Hot Docs.
I had to double check in my mind because there's like 70. It feels like there's 7 million of them anywhere. Hot Docs is very popular. I've been pushing my way through crowds, so hopefully you get a nice attendance, and some of the folks that are listening here go and check it out. I want to thank you very much for coming into the studio today. And for joining me for my news item as well. So thanks very much.
Thank you.
Just to give people a reminder as well that if they're interested, they can check out any contact us through the website, which is greenmajority.ca. We're also available on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm sure some other social media. It's just slipping my mind right now. Our helpful volunteers are usually all over that as well. We are syndicated on 20 stations nationwide as well. And I also would like to thank very much. I've been forgetting to thank him recently, so this is my official big up to Sean O'Neill, who's our technician, coming in and doing a good job every week. And of course, one last final thing here before we start going is that we actually have a bit of a special project coming up soon. I'm not going to spoil exactly what it is, but it's something that if you're in Toronto or in the Toronto area and you would like to actually come down and participate on a special project with the Green Majority, we will be releasing information shortly. So it's a good reason to go and add yourself to the Facebook page right this minute when you're listening, because that's where we'll be putting out the first set of information about how you can get involved with a really cool project we're going to be doing down here. It may or may not involve you getting in a fancily produced video that ends up on YouTube and being part of a campaign. Just a teaser, I won't tell you anymore for now, so you better stay tuned. That is all the time we have for the show this week. You've been listening to The Green Majority. My name is Darren Kaster, and we'll talk to you next week.